the week of June 13th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 58, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And on the Great Wall of China, where I like to do my stretches before we begin the podcast, I'm Michael Giltz.
Why are you on the Great Wall of China now?
It's a Karate Kid reference.
Oh. Yeah, he's in the Kung Fu Kid!
We will be talking about the Karate Kid later on in the episode, I know. But, you know, we do have a ton of news to talk about today. I think the only thing we're not going to touch on is listener email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com because I just don't think we're going to have time for it. In our lightning round, we're going to go through a ton of news, including Angelina Jolie's attempt to one-up Elizabeth Taylor, Tom Cruise's next vehicle, and Kevin Costner's solution to the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. So that's our big deal or big whoop round. And of course, we have to talk about the Tony Awards, which were held last night. Brian Scott Lipton, the editor-in-chief over at Theater Mania, will join us to go over all the high points. Then there was another award show. Stephen Garrett of Kinetic Trailers, who was here last year at this time, will stop by to discuss this year's Golden Trailer Awards, which were presented last Thursday. And we now know the final rankings of this past season's television shows, and we'll tell you which of your favorite shows came out on top. Finally, we'll talk about racial and ethnic diversity in today's TV programming during Inside Baseball. But first, as always, we turn it over to the entertainment journalist Michael Giltz, who, when he's not writing for the Huffington Post or doing stretches on the Great Wall of China, is filling us in on what happened at the box office this past weekend.
That's right. The biggest star in the Smith family is apparently Jaden Smith, whose film The Karate Kid, his first starring role, opened at number one in the box office, far exceeding all expectations. It grossed $56 million in the U.S. alone, and it only cost $40 million to make. So when your movie grosses more than its budget in the first weekend, you've had a good first weekend. Well back at number two was The A-Team with $26 million. That was under expectations, about half the gross that The Karate Kid did. Number three is Shrek Forever After, which grossed $15.8 million, dropped about 38%. It's at $210 million in the U.S. and hasn't even opened in a lot of markets overseas. So just like Iron Man 2, I think eventually we'll have to call Shrek Forever After a winner, at least in terms of grosses. And number four is Get Him to the Greek, which grossed $10 million, $36 million total. Not bad for a movie that costs $40 million to make. Number five is Killers, the rather anonymous comedy action film starring Katherine Heigl and Ashton Kutcher. That grossed $8 million. That's at $30 million total. And six through ten were holdovers. Prince of Persia, The Sand of Time, grossed $6.6 million. It's at $72 million total. It almost certainly won't hit $100 million in the U.S. But worldwide, it's grossed $260 million. Marmaduke is a complete flop. It's at $22 million total. Sex in the City 2, again, that's at $84 million total in the U.S. That will have trouble hitting $100 million, but it's grossed $130 million overseas, so that means that's at $210 million, so that's a success. And Iron Man 2 is just about where Iron Man 1 was. It's grossed $600 million total worldwide. And then a little horror film called Splice, which is at $13 million total, which I saw this weekend along with Karate Kid, and at number 11, Robin Hood, which is just under $100 million in the U.S., and I think about $160, $180 million overseas. So again, not a success, but not a disaster.
You know, I'm still trying to wrap my head around this thing that you said at the head of that segment. If you make more money, if you gross more money than the film actually costs, then it's successful. Is that what you were saying?
No. If you gross the film's budget in the first weekend, you've had a very good weekend. That's what I said. Your film costs $30 million to make, you gross $30 million, that's a good first weekend. If you cost $80 million to make and you gross $80 million, that's a good first weekend.
I guess maybe my sarcasm has to be a little bit more pronounced. Because it's, you know, such a rarity in Hollywood for a film to actually gross more than it costs to make, at least this summer.
Well, it's been a weak summer, but Karate Kid 2 is definitely a success story. It exceeded everyone's expectations. I saw some weird comments. People said things like before it opened, well, the people who grew up with it have already seen it, so why will they care? And blah, blah. I'm like, well, they have kids. Now they're going to take their kids to it. To me, it seemed like a no-brainer. But like you said, I saw it this weekend. It is a long movie. It's 2 hours and 20 minutes, which I have to say, it wasn't a very good movie, but it didn't seem long, so I'm not quite sure how that happened. I have no idea how the studio let it go out with that long of a running time. But, you know, it was The Karate Kid. Instead of L.A., it's set in China. Instead of Pat Morita, you get Jackie Chan. Instead of Ralph Macchio, you get Jaden Smith. And instead of karate, you get kung fu.
And instead of wax on, wax off, you get jacket on, jacket off. On.
And instead of the stork, you get the cobra for the big finale.
I think the cobra is a little bit of a better a name,
yeah,
at least.
A little more frightening. Yeah, exactly. Did either of you see it?
I have not seen the finished version, no.
Oh, right. You saw an earlier cut. You wouldn't go twice. What about you, Karen?
No, I didn't. I finally saw Letters to Juliet.
Oh, how was it? Now, that's a movie that's been chugging along. Where is that at right now? That has grossed about...
I think it came in 12th.
Mm-hmm.
Right past Robin Hood.
I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. It was sweepingly romantic. It's a total chick flick. But, you know, the guy in it, Christopher Egan, is much more charming than I thought he was going to be. He had no chemistry with her, which is unfortunate. But it was a really enjoyable movie.
And that's grossed $46 million in the U.S. alone, so it hasn't really opened overseas, so it's definitely been chugging along. Now, Christopher Egan, he was the star of a TV series I liked a lot called Kings, which is out on DVD. It's much better. It's a strange little show, but and of course, he was in Paolini, the fantasy film. So he's an interesting young actor.
They keep trying to push him as a star, and unfortunately, he's just not. He's a nice-looking guy who happens to be pretty funny, actually. Surprisingly funny, but he's not a star.
Hmm. I liked him in Kings, but well, there you go.
No, I did too. I liked him in Letters to Juliet. It didn't work.
Yeah.
Well, now they're calling the A-Team kind of a flop, but last week, Carl DiOrio said it would make around $30 million. It was tracking to do $30 million. It made $26 million, so it did a little under that. Usually when something's tracking to do 30, you hope it does 32, 33, 34, somewhere in there. So, you know, it did what everybody thought it would do, which is around $30 million. But the problem is it cost $110 million to make the thing.
Yeah, tracking it properly doesn't have anything to do with its success or failure.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I guess, yeah. I don't know what people were expecting out of that film, but $26 million is, you know, it's average for a live-action television adaptation in terms of implied audience. Yes, I was reading that.
Wow. Well, that's
I saw
impressive.
That on Box Office, you know, probably. Sorry.
I'd be curious if they had done, you know, because there are companies that do social media tracking for this kind of thing. And I'd be curious to know how dead on they were. Because I bet people were talking about it in terms of,
what a
either
dumb idea.
This sounds really stupid, or women were probably talking about Bradley Cooper's abs.
And what were you talking about?
Bradley Cooper's abs.
Well,
my God.
Like you said, Sperling, I think it was boxofficeprofits.com, talked about, listed like the last 10 TV adaptations like Charlie's Angels and said, well, those did about this or this. You know, those are apples, you know, trying to say, well, it's this type of genre, and that's such a Hollywood way to think. It's this type of genre adapted from this type of property, and therefore it should make this amount of money. It's so silly, you know. I mean, it has name recognition, so it should make a certain amount, and they spent a lot of money on it, so they promoted it. But, you know, just because it's adapted from a TV show doesn't mean it should make $30 million. You know, it's just, I don't know. It seems such a crazy way to think about movies.
No, I totally agree. I think the bottom line is just that it did not look like a very good movie.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, in the LA Times today, they did the same thing. They had this whole article on should the studios continue to adapt 1980s television shows or 1980s properties into films. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I'm sure
they should do anything that seems like a good idea and not do something like they should do 80s but not 60s TV show. I mean, it's just TV shows have been ripe for remake for a long time. There's no reason why they won't continue to. God willing, they'll only do it when it seems like a good idea for a movie, but, you know. I'm sure Benson will become a movie.
But the argument, though, versus, you know, remaking an 80s versus a 60s has to do with, you know, how close a generation is to it, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember Karate Kid and the A-Team. It does make a difference. Some people want to watch it for that very reason, and some people really don't. But a lot of the movies that they remake from, like, the 50s and 60s, you know, generation-wise, never even heard of. It's not a remake to them.
But, you know, you have to treat it like you're introducing the movie anyway. If you've got a built-in audience that's just lucky, you know, the A-Team, you know.
Well, maybe the reason that all of these films are doing so poorly is because they can't attract the big names because all those big names are on Broadway. At least that's the impression I get after watching the Tony Awards.
Nice try, but...
No? Okay. Well, it was a nice try at a segue. But, you know, we probably should at this point bring in Brian Scott Lipton, the editor-in-chief of Theater Mania. Why don't I give him a call?
Brian Lipton.
Hi, Brian. It's Sperling, and I have Karen Woodward and Michael Giltz on the line. Michael Giltz arranged for you to talk to us about the Tony Awards.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Hello.
Now, the Tony...
So, the Tony Awards... I thought, being the gay man, I thought I would take over.
Okay, no, go ahead.
So, the Tony Awards were last night, and big winners included Memphis, which won for Best Musical, which my friend TJ predicted the day he saw the show months and months ago. He said, I love it, and it's going to win the Tony for Best Musical. So, TJ was right. Red won Best Play. It's a play about painting and art, and it's a transfer from the UK, like a lot of shows this year, including La Cage aux Folles, which won the Best Musical Revival. And then there was Fences, which in my mind is practically the big winner of the night, which won Best Play Revival, Best Actor, and Best Actress. The show reached about 7 million viewers. Unlike the Oscars and some other award shows, it was lower than last year, but it did face Game 5 of the NBA Finals, which was the highest rated in like 6 years. So there's a lot to talk about. So Brian, tell us, what did you think of the show overall as a show itself?
I think as a show overall, in terms of the broadcast, I thought John Hayes was really an adorable host and really kept the show moving very well. I think it's great to see so many big names from both the theater industry and from Hollywood come out and support Broadway, and to even have sports stars like Mark Sanchez up there.
Yeah.
So that, you know, everybody can love theater. And that's the message I think Broadway needs to get out. And I got a particular kick, frankly, watching all of those great Broadway people just get so excited watching Green Day rock the house. They seem more excited by that performance than any of the theater performances.
Yeah, they clapped along, and a lot of times at award shows, the people in front do not get excited.
Yeah, there's some little old lady who was like a Betty White lookalike who was really rocking yes. out.
I have to say, Green Day does not strike me as the kind of music that the crowd who attends the Tony Awards would actually be into. Nathan Lane looked completely uncomfortable clapping along to that song, and it was, you know, 5 minutes into the show. Green Day, this three-member basically punk rock band, which now, I guess one of their albums was turned into a Broadway musical, American Idiot.
Right, an American Idiot.
It was nominated for, I guess, Best Musical.
Three Tonys.
Three, and which was a bit of a surprise that it didn't do better in the nomination. It was really almost sort of the favorite before the season started or as soon as it was announced. And I do think that perhaps... the fact that it only ended up getting three nominations, two of them in the technical categories, showed perhaps, you're right, that there are some older or more traditional Broadway people who didn't feel as comfortable with it as they did with other material. But it's got a huge audience who loves it, and it'll go back again and again. And they'll bring young people into the theater, and that's just as important as anything right now.
Well, now, to your point, I'm going to play a little clip here, and I want you to tell me... Well, you'll know by the end what award show this is, but this is what struck me. 39 minutes into the telecast, there was this particular kind of teaser for some of the upcoming segments.
Coming up, Antonio Banderas, Denzel Washington, Scarlett Johansson, and Michael Douglas. Plus, performances from Memphis, Lea Michele and Matthew Morrison from Glee, and Catherine Zeta-Jones on the Tony Awards. Only CBS.
Now, when I heard that promo, I thought, wait, am I watching the Tony Awards or am I watching the Academy Awards? Because all of those people are movie stars.
Yes, we have a lot of movie stars on Broadway right now. And I have had over, you know, I mean, I think it's always been true, but certainly right now and in the last couple of years and a couple of years to come, definitely. They move back and forth with alarming speed.
Well, there are people there that you wouldn't normally expect to find, like Denzel Washington, for instance.
Except Denzel is a trained theater actor. I mean, he began his career off Broadway. And I've had the pleasure of talking to Denzel a couple of times this year. And I think like lots of people, if they could have made a real living as a theater actor, I'm not sure we would have lost some of these people to Hollywood. Catherine Zeta-Jones started in the musicals of England. But, you know, we don't pay like Hollywood, no matter how big you are.
Well, Catherine Zeta-Jones sang a Stephen Sondheim song, Bring In the Clowns, I believe.
Send In the Clowns.
And it
That was haunting. That was so good.
Really? You think it was good? I was listening to it going,
I loved it.
I've heard better renditions of that song, and I thought she kind of played it over the top. And then reading all of the reviews this morning, everybody thought the same thing. And then she goes and wins the Tony Award and acts so surprised when award after award, it always seemed to go to, more often than not, the well-known celebrity.
Yeah, how do we feel about that?
Okay, I think there's a lot of factors. Having seen the performance on stage, I mean, I think television is a very different medium than theater. You're dealing with a close-up, and also because of the way it was staged for the award, A, it's completely out of context. I mean, I know to some people, Send Them the Clowns may even almost be a pop song, but it has a very specific place in the show, which you can't necessarily see in the show, and especially because they filmed it without a scene before, after, or without her co-star. Her delivery, to me, didn't seem that dramatically different than when I had heard it in the theater. As far as her being surprised, my sense of having dealt with theater actors for over 20 years is that they're always, any kind of actors, is that no matter how many predictions and how many previous awards they've won, they always seem surprised when they win. Catherine had tied for the Outer Critics Circle and the Drama Desk Award with Montego Glover, and I think many people had predicted she would win, but that doesn't mean that in her heart she believed she was going to.
Now, Scarlett Johansson, I guess she's a pretty young actress in her mid to late 20s, and it was her first time on Broadway. She winds up winning the Tony Award for her performance in A View from the Bridge, or is it The View from... God, I'm really screwing up all the titles.
Yes, A View from the Bridge.
A View from the Bridge. She won, and she gave a very long, long, long speech, which I was surprised wasn't cut off. I think she thanked everyone, including me. you know...
Lisa, most importantly, she thanked her husband, Ryan Reynolds. So often they get up there and they're so nervous and excited, they forget to thank their spouses. And usually when I see them afterwards, that's the thing they're most regretful about. But she did thank a lot of people. And she thanked Arthur Miller, the playwright, which I thought was a very classy thing of her to do, and her co-stars and her director.
And that was the first award given out. It was kind of like a precursor for the whole night. I mean, one would think that she would work her way up to a Tony Award. She wins right out of the gate.
One thing I have to say about the Tony Awards is, and having been a voter, I did not vote this year. As you may or may not know, the select press that were voters were, how to put this, disenfranchised this year. We were kind of thrown off. But one thing I will say, I think, about Tony voters is that unlike Oscars or some of the other organizations, it's not a group that tends to deal a lot with sentiment or that kind of rule thinking. People really often vote for what they truly believe was the best performance. And she certainly did do a wonderful job. And also, she is not somebody who is a complete stranger to theater. As she said in her speech, she was pounding the pavement when she was six. She did an off-Broadway show when she was eight that I think I actually might have even seen. and although it is her Broadway show, she's not just some Hollywood interloper. But I tend to think that if somebody came in and never worked on a stage before and just blew us away with a great performance, we would vote for them.
Well, you know, watching the show, I feel like maybe the biggest winner of the night was the TV series Glee. Matthew Morrison got all these close-ups, including a scene with La Cage aux Folles, which was very funny. He did a big number, All I Need Is the Girl. And then Lea Michele ran through one of the biggest show-stopping numbers of all time, Don't Rain on My Parade. What did you think of their performances and the overall attention and respect that Glee got?
You know, I think it's a nice sort of full circle. Lea and Matt are both really Broadway babies. I mean, Lea, truly, she did Ragtime when she was eight, and then, of course, Spring Awakening a few years ago. And Matt's been working on Broadway for about 10 years. So to me, Glee is a show about my friends who I knew from Broadway. So this was a great bit of full circle. And if it showed a little more of their talent, and even, you know, ironically, probably the Tony audience wasn't as big as the Glee audience. You know, I watched All I Needed the Girl and thought, well, they could have worked that into Glee. It would have been great for Mr. Schuster. But maybe it was something he wanted to do this year and didn't get to do. But Matt's an extraordinarily talented guy who can really do everything. He can act, he can sing, and he can dance. I've known that for 10 years. And Leah sings like nobody's business. And to get to do that particular number, which she had done on Glee, was just a great opportunity for her.
I thought it was very interesting that they kept teasing the fact that Leah and whose name I'm now forgetting, that Matthew Morrison. Matthew Morrison, who I saw in South Pacific a couple of years ago at Lincoln Center, and Leah.
Right, and he did Hairspray and Live in the Piazza, and I could do all Matty's credits, but he would be bored.
Yeah, that I thought it was very interesting. They kept teasing it again and again throughout the broadcast, almost as a way of saying, kids, stay tuned. Literally, kids, stay tuned.
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm sure that had to be part of their thinking, that there was an audience that maybe doesn't normally watch the Tony Awards and was watching it because of Glee, and you want to keep them glued to your set as long as you can before it starts to look really silly that you haven't given out the big awards yet. On the other hand, you know, Kristen Chenoweth is a huge star, and they got her off on and off fairly quickly on the broadcast, even though she did come back for some joking around with Sean Hayes. So
now there was something kind of like an insider joke there. I guess Newsday or Newsweek had said
Newsweek, not Newsday. Not pick up my friends. Newsday.
Yeah, sorry. Newsweek kind of put a little dig into Sean Hayes and Ellen Chenoweth, who are in the musical Promises, Promises.
That yes, Sean and Kristen are co-starring in Promises, Promises, where they play eventual sort of love interests. And yes, there was a big article in Newsweek where the writer posited that he didn't believe that openly gay performers like Sean is could convincingly play straight. It's a kind of ridiculous comment. Anybody who has seen any number of actors, including Sean, who does a wonderful job in Promises, know that that's a ridiculous comment to make. And I thought it was kind of very funny how the two of them, who are great friends even before they did the show together, chose to handle it on national television.
Yeah, and they kind of, I guess, she came out in the middle of his monologue there and gave him this big wet, and I mean wet. There were
yeah,
tongues flying around.
Like.
Yeah, kiss. And it was a little awkward, actually. It was, and I think especially
for... Well, I do kind of wonder, you know, I mean, not everybody reads Newsweek or is up on the controversy, and I guess either that there are probably a handful of people who watch the Tony Awards who wasn't sure what that was all about. But I think for most of the audience, they were in on the joke.
I certainly had no idea what the joke was. And of course, then...
It took me a second to get it.
Yeah.
I was really far too distracted about on how short Kristen's dress was.
Oh, me too.
I forgot it was tiny.
On the kiss. I was just afraid that we were going to see more than we needed to. And
now, what are you looking forward to, Brian, in the upcoming theater season in the summer and this fall? Is there something specifically, besides, of course, Spider-Man, because who wouldn't look forward to something like Spider-Man? Which...
Well, we look forward to Spider-Man if we kind of know that it's ever going to get here. But yes, we always look forward to what the brilliant Julie Taymor has to offer us. It's a very quiet theater in terms of Broadway or even pretty much off-Broadway. Pretty quiet summer. But the fall is already looking incredibly chock full of new offerings. We get the great Terry Jones back in a revival of Mrs. Warren's Profession. We get Patrick Stewart and Keira Knight together in David Mamet's The Life in the Theater. We get another chance to see Time Stand Still, and I have to say, nobody is happier than I than Viola Davis won the Tony for Fences, but at the same time, Laura Linney, who was nominated against her for Time Stand Still, which we saw earlier this season, was probably the second best performance I saw this year. And so the fact that everybody gets another chance to see what she and her castmates do, a new production of this bizarre play called La Bette with the amazing Mark Rylance, David Hyde Pierce, and Av Fabs, Joanna Lumley, is like a not to be missed. Another chance at John Kander and Fred Ebb, the Scottsboro Boys. It's already looking to be like an amazing fall. And I think people need to start saving their money now and come to Broadway. And to go back to something you said very early in the broadcast about things coming over from Britain, we are very lucky that the British sometimes produce things that we don't produce right away, and we are the beneficiaries of their inventiveness. with or their willingness to take maybe more of a risk than we can on Broadway. But I do want to point out that Red is written actually by an American. John Logan is a true, you know, American boy.
Oh, yes.
And even though it was first done over in the Donmar, it is an American play about an American subject.
Yes, Mark Rothko and his assistant. And I have to say,
His fictional assistant.
Yes, his fiction, yes. John Logan, I know from being a screenwriter. I worked with him at Creative Artists Agency many, many years ago. This was in like 95, 96, when he was just breaking into screenwriting. And he had written plays, but he was primarily known for, I guess, his screenwriting. And just the nicest guy in the world. Could not say.
John Logan is truly, if you're listening, John, one of the nicest guys in the world. And John made a comment last night that he would be happier at the Tonys than at the Oscars any day. So partially because, of course, he's won one. And it was found that, of course, Gladiator won Best Picture. But
yeah, he did not
even
win.
Though he was the screenwriter and so heavily involved in it, you know, he didn't get an Oscar for it.
Yeah,
playwriting and theater is different. When Red wins Best Play, he gets to take home the Tony.
I just want to ask you a question about what Charles McNulty wrote in the Los Angeles Times. He says, in a world that has become violently unpredictable, Broadway's biggest night never fails to live up to its staid reputation. So what if it poisons the creative well for the next decade? And his big thing was that Memphis won, which was not the best musical, but it will tour very well, and the Tonys know that. The Tony voters know that. So, of course, they nominate, they pick it to win because they need some type of tie-in when it hits the national, when it goes on national tour. Do you agree with that statement?
I think theater has the place for so many different types of musicals. Memphis is a really well-put-together, well-structured, traditional with a story, with an original score, and there is always a place for that. And whether or not it was the beneficiary of a producer's voting for it, but it will travel well on the road, or just its competition, I think it's really irrelevant. I don't think the Tonys should in any way be blamed or even conversely praised for favoring one form of musical over the other. It's really a question of what the audience has come to see. And they're supporting all of those different shows.
Now I want to just, before we let you go, revisit something you said earlier. You mentioned that this year, the Tony Academy, or the Academy, I should know, they repeated it 500 times last night. The
American Theater Wing and the Broadway League present the Tony Awards. I'm not sure where we're going.
Yeah. Well, they said that they kind of disenfranchised journalists who were voting members.
Yeah.
Why? What happened? What's going on there?
At the beginning of last July, sort of as the seasons were transitioning, the 100 and so members of the what are known as the First Night League list, which are essentially working first night theater critics and some editors like myself and other people, were just summarily informed that we were not going to be Tony voters this year. And there was rather minimal explanation as to why that was being done. All I know as of now is that they've already agreed to reinstate, if you want to call it that, approximately 20 journalists who are the members of the New York Drama Critics Circle, which are the leading first night critics in New York. Our critic David Finkel represents Theater Mania. I do not at this point. And it's possible by the end of the year, we may all be back. I mean, one thing that was pointed out is that we are pretty much the only industry where the press did ever vote. I mean, it is true. The press does not vote for the Oscars or the Grammys or the Emmys. So that was part of their argument that we don't, they were just following belatedly the lead of other award organizations and not having the press do it. And of course, we're a smaller group. I mean, there were only about 700 Tony voters to begin with. So the press made up, I think, something like 15-16%.
Well, Brian Scott Lipton, editor-in-chief of Theater Mania, you've been there 6 years. It's kind of hard to believe any journalist these days has been there 6 years. Thank you very much for joining us. Unfortunately, Michael dropped off. We can't seem to bring him back, but Karen and I at least, thank you for joining us to talk about this year's Tony Awards.
My pleasure, anytime. Thank you so much.
Is there a website we should send people to, or a...
It is www.theatermania, and that is theatermania.com. And you can check us out for all our news, listings, reviews, features, a lot of Tony coverage for those of you who want to see what happened last night. We put up about 60 photos today, but every day we put up dozens of new things for you to learn about theater.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time after what must have been a hectic evening last night to join us and fill us in on everything.
My pleasure. Anytime, Sterling.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hold on. Let's see if we can get our friend Michael Giltz back.
Hello.
You must be so pissed that you missed all of...
Oh, it was the best the stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah, he gave away all the secrets on how to win a Tony Award.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Not only that, he told us how to cure cancer. You totally missed it.
Yeah, but here's the thing. We're not allowed to tell you until after the podcast is...
Yeah, it's not even going to go up.
Yeah. Sorry, man. Meanwhile, we have a patent to file. Gotta run. Well, I'm sorry if you fell off there.
Well, Sperling, if you weren't a big fan of Catherine Zeta-Jones, you might want to check out A Little Night Music in July, because that's when Bernadette Peters and Elaine Stritch, two Broadway legends, take over the roles created by Catherine Zeta-Jones and Angela Lansbury.
Who are they? Who are these Bernadette and this Elaine Stritch?
So it'd be a great time to check out the show. It'd be easy to get tickets in the summer, and those are two pros that know Sondheim inside and out.
Bernadette Peters does not age.
I know. It's unbelievable.
She was the most boring interview I have ever given in my life.
Yeah, I can see that.
She was so difficult. I mean, she wasn't difficult in the sense of obnoxious, but just not there, just not interested. It was like pulling teeth. You know, I would answer these elaborate questions. I'd done all this. Yes, no. You're like, all right, you don't want to give an interview. I get it, but what a talent. So there you go.
Now, speaking of interviews, I know that we have to get Stephen Garrett of Kinetic Trailers on the line here to talk about the Golden Trailer Awards, and for sake of time, I'm just going to dial him up here, not to transition too quickly from Tony's to trailers, but let me just hold on a sec. Okay. Dial him up.
Hello?
Hi, Stephen. It's Sperling, and I've got Karen Woodward and Michael Giltz on the line.
Hi, Stephen.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Hello.
And I should say, it's not just Stephen. It's two-time Golden Trailer Award-winning Stephen Garrett.
Why, thank you. Yes, that's true.
Joining us from your cavernous office space in New York City.
That's true.
Kinetic Trailers. Now, the Golden Trailer Awards, this is the second time we've had you on the show to talk about the Golden Trailer Awards. You are a trailer editor and producer, correct?
That's correct. Yes, I am.
And that's effectively what Kinetic Trailers does.
Oh, very much so. Yeah, that's almost exclusively what we do is make trailers, but specifically for foreign language films, art house films, documentaries, things that are not really studio films.
And the 11th Annual Trailer Awards were held in Los Angeles last Thursday. And I guess I should go over some of the other winners for, I don't want to say the big films, but some of the more mainstream films. Sherlock Holmes won for Best Action. Shrek Forever After won for Best Animation and Family. For Best Drama was Brothers. Antichrist won Best Horror. Who cut that, Steven?
Oh, that was me, actually.
Exactly. Best Romance went to The Young Victoria. And A Serious Man picked up the Independent Trailer Award, which isn't really an independent trailer, but the film was independent. So now you picked up probably the most fun award, or the best award of the night, the trashiest trailer.
That's true. That's true. And in my opinion, the most coveted award, because that's something I won it. That's true. I did win it for a movie called The Human Centipede. First Sequence is the full title, which is a stomach churning movie about a mad scientist who connects three people ass to mouth in a sort of centipede. And then he removes their kneecaps so they can't extend their legs. Anyway, I was very happy not to work on this. And the client actually even said, look, I'd understand if you don't want to cut the trailer for this. And I was like, no, what the hell? And it turned out to be a lot of fun. And then it was a very trashy movie that I could submit to the trashiest award category.
Yeah, and I have to say that this year, unlike in previous years, the event, the Golden Trailer Awards, was held in a non-movie theater environment. Last year it was held at the DGA movie theater. In years past, it's always been in some type of movie theater or theater environment. This year they held it at the El Rey Theater, which is effectively, what, a musical concert venue, a small nightclub. And that's the way it was set up. So there was constant chatter going on throughout the entire evening. However, when it came to the trashiest trailer, everybody was paying attention. I did notice that.
True. I didn't think about that.
And I also noticed, and I think I was standing next to you, Stephen, at this point, when they showed the Human Centipede clips, everybody exploded into applause and laughter and cheering. And I turned to you and I said, I think you're going to win this one.
Well, the premise certainly captures your imagination. And I think people had a lot of fun with that. So, you know, I think that's you know, I'd like to say that quality is the only determinant when winning any kind of award. But I think there's also a certain amount of, you know, there's that X factor in terms of the just the general appeal of the movie. And I think people really reacted to this positively or negatively.
And if you want to see the trailer, you can go to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/showbizsandbox. It's there. I've shown it to so many people and it stays with you. I mean, people were talking about it 3 days later.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. For better or for worse, it stays with you. Yeah. It's a disgusting film. I can't really recommend it. But I think the trailer's good.
Now, Stephen, how has editing trailers changed in the year since we've talked to you, or has it not changed at all?
I think it had its most profound change probably in the early to mid-90s when offline editing, computer editing, really came into its own. And you had the opportunity not only to do a lot of fast cutting without taking too much time, but also you could save earlier cuts. You know, you could go back and look at what you've edited before. So it was easier to see earlier cuts, and it was also easier to show clients different cuts. And so I think there was an explosion of creativity then. But things have pretty much stayed the same as far as I can tell. The biggest change in my specific little niche is that with foreign language films, distributors have gotten a lot more comfortable with letting people speak their native tongue. So it used to be that if you were releasing a film in a foreign language, you didn't want to show people talking at all. You wanted to kind of almost hide the fact that it was a foreign language film. And you would just bombard the trailer with tons of voiceover. And it would look like a story of deaf mutes because it would just be a lot of longing glances and teary expressions or violent outbursts, but you never hear anybody talk. And so that, I'm glad that's loosened up, but maybe almost too much because the floodgates have now opened and there seems to be far too many, in my estimation, subtitles in a lot of trailers. You know, it used to be actually, you know, as they say, you know, those restraints kind of force you to be a little more creative. And if you couldn't have people talking, you made a trailer that was a little more moody, a little more atmospheric, and a little more mysterious. And I think that's been toned down a little bit in favor of clarity and plot and exposition. So it's a trade-off. It's a trade-off. I think we've gone the other extreme now, and it would be nice to meet somewhere in the middle.
Well, I always thought it looked a little desperate when they sort of had a foreign film but refused to let you know it was in a foreign language, and they always seemed to bend over backwards to try and hide that fact.
I know, it's true. It's true. Or even more insultingly, if it's an Italian movie, they would only let people say, like, ciao, and, you know, hey, oh. You know, if it's French, they'd be like, oui, oui, au revoir. You know, it's kind of stupid. It was very, very, you know, like French 101 or whatever.
Well, now, do the Golden Trailer Awards actually help you? I mean, you've won two of them this year. I know you've won, you probably have a dozen, if not more, of these things hanging around your office. Do they actually help when you're going out there to seek work? Do people say, well, you know, they do have a lot of Golden Trailer Awards?
Yeah, I don't know if they say that specifically, but they do say, oh, you know, it's what's nice about this is that there's an outside body that has determined that your worth, you know? That it's not necessarily just you saying that you're great. It's some other independent voice saying, no, 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 they're really great. And it's some, you know, trailers are not something that are reviewed by critics, so you can't use, you know, reviews for your work. And your work is generally unsigned. You know, when you, it's a piece of advertising, and so it would be redundant, I think, to, or not redundant, but it would be you don't use a piece of promotion to promote yourself, per se. You know what I mean? Even though that's what we're doing with the Golden Trailer Awards, and that's what's nice. So the Golden Trailer Awards put a spotlight on what is basically an invisible art. Editing is I think a lot of people don't really understand editing as easily as they do cinematography or writing. You know, cinematography, you go, oh, that's cinematography. Or writing, you hear dialogue, and you go, oh, that's dialogue. But editing is a little more elusive, so it's harder to get recognition for it. And frankly, anything that allows you to promote yourself in that way is a big help. So I would say, yeah, I mean, you know, it's a nice thing to have. They're not as well known as the Key Arts. You could even arguably say they're not as respected as the Key Arts, because Key Art Awards have been around for, what, 30, 40 years, something like that, longer?
These are the awards, the Key Art Awards, given to not only trailers, but also posters and advertising campaigns for movies.
Exactly. They're the whole umbrella, I guess, any sort of advertising for film and television. Or maybe just for film, but they do television spots for films and things like that, standees that are in the lobby, one sheets, billboards, all that kind of stuff, you know. So, and of course, because of that, was that? Yeah, bus sides, exactly. So they're very well respected, and the mainstream studios, you know about them and use them to promote themselves and all that stuff, you know. But they're the specific category of trailers, they only have, I think, maybe two or four categories or something. They've expanded it somewhat, but it's basically action or comedy, you know. I think it's like action underrated, you know, PG and under action, and then R action, and then PG and under comedy, R comedy. But the Golden Trailers, they have more categories. So on the one hand, it's easier, I guess you could look at it, it's easier to win them because there are more categories. But on the other hand, you do find yourselves being able to get attention for a really, you know, specific thing, like, you know, foreign romance trailer, or, you know, best independent trailer, or, you know, most original trailer. There's some nice categories in there, aside from like the blockbuster, summer blockbuster trailer, best in show. Those are the ones that tend to go to the studios. But it's nice, from my point of view, I work at in a niche industry, and it's nice to have recognition for that.
You mentioned all the categories, and I guess we should say that a couple things. One, The Cove won two awards. It won Best Documentary, and it also won Best in Show. So that was kind of the big winner of the night. Last year, it was Star Trek for Best in Show.
Star Trek was good.
And then there was this award called the Golden Fleece, which is an award given to a film or a trailer that makes the film look amazing and makes you want to race to the movie theater and see it. And then when you do, the movie is horrible. And this year it was given to Bad Lieutenant, I guess, Port of Call, New Orleans.
That's pretty funny. I like that movie. So, but I like the trailer too. I thought the trailer was good. You know, but I could see why it's a loony film, and the trailer actually, I think, made it look a little more conventional, and maybe that's the fleece aspect of it.
Well, now I saw your cut of the Antichrist trailer, which won the Best Horror Award, and it really does make me want to see the film again. And I swore after walking out of that movie, I would never see that film again. But it actually made me want to revisit it. Now, you do a lot of independent films like Antichrist, and then I noticed there are those companies that were winning, like Mojo or Aspect Ratio or AV Club, that were winning for pretty big studio films. And it seemed like there was a big divide between the independent film trailer producers and the studio trailer producers. Is there a way to jump from doing independents to doing studio films and vice versa, from studio films to independents?
Well, I guess it depends on what you want to be paid. The people who work on studio stuff get paid very well for stuff, so I think they would laugh at the kind of budgets that I command for the work that I do. Now, I have a very small office. You know, it's my partner and I, and we have an assistant, and then we have some freelancers we work with, but we have very low overhead. So, you know, we don't have a lot of expenses, so the budgets that we have, though modest to big LA vendors, are perfectly fine for us. But those big LA vendors, they have a huge support staff. They keep a lot of editors with very big salaries on staff, you know, like maybe 8 or 10 or 12 editors plus producers plus copywriters. They just have a very large facility with a lot of hard costs, a lot of equipment costs and things like that. And that all takes a lot of money. So they would probably say, you know what, it's not really worth it to us to work on an IFC film job or a Magnolia job, because they can't afford to pay us what we command, you know, by the big studios, you know, like a Star Trek budget. So I think they would probably laugh at the stuff that I want to work on. Also, you need to be in LA to be really successful at working a lot of LA films. So I think it's possible to do the crossover. I think it just depends on how much will there is among those people. I don't think the people in L.A. have the will to cross over to my side because I don't think they want to take the budget reductions. And I don't want to cross over to their side because I don't want to live in L.A. and I don't want to necessarily work on, you know, some of the movies that come out. You know, not to be a snob, but I like even something like Antichrist, which divides critics. I know a lot of people who hate it, but I had a lot of fun working on that. And it's a beautiful, beautifully crafted film, regardless of what you might think of the story. I think it's beautifully crafted. And then Lars von Trier, I really respect as a director. So it's a real kind of badge of honor for me to be able to work on something like that.
Well, certainly, thank you for taking the time to join us today to not only talk about the Golden Trailer Awards, but producing trailers in general. Hopefully, you'll be able to join us before next year's Golden Trailer Awards at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to. And thanks for inviting me on. I mean, I love trailers. So I mean, I could talk all night.
Well, thank you, Stephen.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Well, that was really fun. You know, speaking of trailers, I saw a couple because when I went to the movies this weekend, I didn't see quite a trailer, but I saw an extended, like, promotional piece for Inception, the Christopher Nolan film with Leonardo DiCaprio. That looks so cool.
Yeah, it's getting a lot of good word of mouth, actually.
And every time I see a trailer for Toy Story 3, I want to see it more and more, and it's starting to get great reviews, so I'm very excited.
That is a great film. I mean, I saw it in 2D, and it was good. So I think the trailer is fantastic for that film, and I think next year at the Golden Trailer Awards, I wouldn't be surprised if you see a couple of prizes go to that film.
Absolutely.
Well, that was very nice of Stephen to join us to talk about the Golden Trailer Awards. If you want, you can visit his website for his company at kinetictrailers.com, and we'll place a link to it in the show notes. Now, for the sake of time, we should probably move right into television. Not that we want to transition too quickly here, but we're running a little long. Now, Michael, Karen, you have some news for us about how last season's television shows fared, and you know which shows came out on top. So who wants to fill us in? Who wants to take it?
Michael, you should go ahead and take this because it's filled with, it's a list and numbers, and you love lists and numbers.
Well, there's two geeky things that really get me excited about this list. We've got a link to it. It lists basically the top shows of the year in order for total viewers and for adults 18-49, which is the big demographic that advertisers care about. But no matter which way you slice it, the number one and the number two shows in the country last year were American Idol, the performance show, and the results show. They grossed about 24 million, 23 million viewers. And this is the sixth year in a row that American Idol has been the number one show. That's never been done before in TV history, that a show has been number one for 6 years in any way, shape, or form. Only three programs in history have been number one for 5 years, All in the Family and The Cosby Show. You know what massive hits those were. Those were both number one for 5 years in a row. And 60 Minutes, which was also number one for 5 years, but not in consecutive years. Now, if you look at American Idol, like those other shows are sitcoms or news magazine. That's like an hour a week for 60 Minutes. American Idol is on for 4 to 6 hours a week, week after week after week. It's like the equivalent to three hit dramas and two sitcoms. I mean, it's a massive amount of programming. So when you look at the amount of time it's on the air, the effect it has on Fox's schedule, like launching Glee and House, when you look at the number of viewers it reaches and its impact in movies and theater and film, you know, a lot of shows showcase movie stars and theater stars and music stars. American Idol has created them. This is, almost any way you slice it, the biggest hit in TV history.
Wow, that is a huge statement.
Wow, that is a huge statement.
Some shows have run longer. 60 Minutes has been on the air, obviously, for decades. Gunsmoke ran on the air for 20 years. Kelsey Grammer played the character Frasier for 21 years, I believe. But, you know, the massive success it's had for the last 6 years is unbelievable. And, of course, it ends next fall when The X Factor, Simon Cowell's own show, launches and probably takes a bite out of American Idol's audience. But we'll have to see. But no matter what happens, this has been a massively big hit. And then the other really big geeky news is we talked last week about The Big Bang Theory, a hit sitcom on CBS, and how the stars are all banded together to ask for a big pay raise.
Well, they're getting 14.2 million people per episode. I think they deserve a pay raise.
Well, exactly. There are only two sitcoms in the entire top 30, only two, which are Two and a Half Men, which has been on for 7 years and is you know, joining its eighth year this fall, and The Big Bang Theory, both of which reached 14 million viewers, which is about 50% higher than the next rated sitcom. So these are very rare birds to have a sitcom that reach a broad audience anymore. They just don't do it. So that's why they're asking for the big bucks. And on the other end of the scale, you've got The Jay Leno Show, which on Monday nights was ranked 101 out of all TV shows on the air.
And look at the,
and you look at The CW, whose entire schedule ranks from 108 down to the bottom. And the bottom eight shows are all on The CW. It's just not a barely a network. I don't know how they still stay on the air.
I can't believe that Desperate Housewives of all shows is number 13. 14 million
Why?
People
Why
watch
that surprise
show.
You?
Because I don't know anybody that watches it anymore. The first season, yes, but the second, third, fourth, I don't know anybody that watches it.
Oh, I know plenty of people who still watch it.
Wow.
What I found most interesting about this article was reading all the comments on it on Nikki Fink's site about it, and everybody going back and forth between like, what's the CW thinking, and why is Gossip Girl still on, and but Supernatural does so much better than Gossip Girl. Why are they being canceled? I thought that was the most interesting thing.
Well, we will place a link to the Deadline Hollywood article in the show notes so that you can go and look up all the top television shows that they listed there from the past season. We have to move on to, however, our lightning round, Big Deal or Big
Woo!
Whoop.
Woo!
I guess it's a big deal this week. This is our popular segment where we determine which of the week's top entertainment headlines were a big deal and which
Whoop!
Were...
You're not pausing so we can do the special effects.
Oh, okay. Which were a big deal.
Woo-hoo!
You needed to brief him on that.
And which nobody cared about.
Pshaw.
And if you're still with us, thank you. Our first story is about Kevin Costner, and not about one of his movies. Oh, no. He's facing off against James Cameron. Cameron reacted to the BP oil spill disaster with a memo. Costner, he's doing him one better. He's got a machine that can help with the cleanup. It works like a centrifuge to separate oil from water. BP has already ordered 32 of them. Cameron is writing another memo about it. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
We talked about this last week. I think it's a big deal what Kevin Costner is doing. The James Cameron's memo just befuddles me.
Michael?
I think it's a big deal. I mean, it's an actual technical advancement, and it's good enough that they're buying it and using it. So good for Kevin Costner. And he says he's donating 80% of any proceeds that he makes to charitable funds around in the Gulf region, everyone affected by it. So good for him.
Yeah, he was
nice.
He said that he got the idea or decided to invest in this project back in the early 90s. He's put $24 million of his own money into this company.
After the Exxon Valdez disaster. That's what inspired him. Yeah.
And, you know, he said, if you spill it, I will come. That's
God.
I've been telling all week. Okay, so Kevin Costner can help solve the oil spill mess, but can he help solve Whitney Houston, his one-time co-star, who had the biggest hit of her career when Costner suggested she sing Dolly Parton's I Will Always Love You and begin it a cappella, is falling apart on tour. In Copenhagen, the reviews for her concert were disastrous, with hundreds of people walking out, boos during a rambling speech about Michael Jackson, and critics saying she looked like she didn't have long to live. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I say it's a big whoop because we're still waiting to pull herself together. She's been sort of a mess for a while now.
Karen?
Houston, we have a problem. Unfortunately, it's a big whoop. This story has been going on for a while.
Okay. Well, we haven't heard the last of Les Grossman, the ultra-pushy Hollywood producer Tom Cruise played in Tropic Thunder and most recently on the MTV Movie Awards, is getting his own movie. Cruise and Ben Stiller are producing, and Cruise is in talks to reprise the role. He's producing the movie and has to be in talks to take the role? We're guessing producer Tom Cruise can convince actor Tom Cruise to take the part. Anyway, Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
The only reason why it's a big deal is it's such a horrible idea. I hate it when people take secondary characters and put them at the forefront when they shouldn't be.
Michael.
Take me to the Greek. Yeah, I mean, it's just a ridiculous idea for a feature film. But who knows? Maybe the script is good.
Sick of watching ads when you go to the movies? Too bad. This is a story I covered, actually. Last year, movie chains grossed more than $500 million from the ads they show before the trailers begin, which, by the way, is a small pittance compared to national advertising campaigns for television and print. If that's where movie chains make money, soon the ads and the trailers may last longer than the movies. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal within its niche.
Michael?
It's a big deal because we have to watch more ads in the movie theaters. I just wish they would show ads in between movies and start movies on a certain time. You know, if the movie starts at 8:20, start the movie at 8:20. I don't care what you show beforehand.
Well, the actual ads are on before 8:20. It's the trailers that aren't.
I get that like preview show thing where the guy talks for a while, and then at 8:20 you get ads and then trailers and then the movie. But anyway, if I show up, I don't want to have to show up at 8:20 just to avoid ads. I hate seeing ads in theaters. I guess we're all used to it by now, but it drives me nuts.
What do costume epics need more of? A little Salt, apparently. Angelina Jolie stars in the summer action blockbuster Salt. But she's got her eye on the Queen of the Nile. Yes, Jolie is signed to play Cleopatra in an ambitious epic overseen by producer Scott Rudin, who won a Tony Award last night. Elizabeth Taylor, of course, starred in the last movie biopic of Cleopatra, a massive affair reportedly still the most expensive movie of all time. That co-starred Taylor's husband, Richard Burton, so the pressure is on for Brad Pitt to take on Mark Anthony as well. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is a big whoop because I'm not sure how true it is.
Michael?
Why don't you believe it? Scott Rudin's acquired the rights to a book, Queen of the Nile, Cleopatra, A Life by Stacey Schiff, and Angelina Jolie signed on to play her.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's saying it's pretty accurate.
I say it's a big deal. It's a big, massive thing. It's another shot for her to, it's a fascinating character. That last movie was a dreadful one with the Elizabeth Taylor one, but it's, you know, certainly a fascinating project.
Well, maybe if she falls out, they can get Lindsay Lohan, unless Lindsay Lohan is headed to TV. Donald Trump is reportedly wooing the troubled actress to appear on the next edition of his reality show, Celebrity Apprentice. That is, assuming she can get time off her bad behavior after Lohan claimed her alcohol warning bracelet only went off at the MTV Movie Awards because someone spilled a drink on it. That is always my excuse. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal that Donald Trump would think she's sort of at the level to be brought onto Celebrity Apprentice.
Karen?
Yeah, that's sad, and I agree.
I don't know. When I said that Celebrity Apprentice was for, you know, washed up celebrities, you all laughed at me and said, no, it's for, you know, it's got good ratings and it's for, you know, but now.
Yeah, but it's not for movie stars. It's for people who are, you know,
from the other reality shows or TV. Or sports stars. Yeah.
All right. Well, you know, we should move on because if you don't like Lindsay Lohan on The Apprentice and you don't like Angelina Jolie in Cleopatra, well, then maybe you'll like Don Quixote as a franchise? The Miguel Cervantes novel, often at or near the top of polls listing the greatest novels of all time, is getting the summer movie blockbuster treatment. Warner Brothers and Joel Silver think what the novel was missing were some explosions and killer action scenes. Their take on the novel is that Quixote wasn't crazy, and there really were monsters and not just windmills. Think Pirates of the Caribbean. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Oh, God. Save us.
Okay. On that note, Michael.
Big whoop.
I couldn't. What a bizarre, ridiculously awful idea for a film. Don Quixote as a, oh, God. That just makes me queasy.
There's a lot of God talk around Don Quixote. You notice that? Speaking of Pirates of the Caribbean, actor Jeffrey Rush will be joining Johnny Depp in the next edition of the franchise. So Orlando Bloom and Keira Knightley are looking for what work, but Jeffrey Rush is essential for the Pirates movies. Teenage girls everywhere are very, very angry. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is the definition of a big whoop.
Karen?
Yes, it is a definite. Just talk. Jeffrey Rush. You lost me there.
Okay.
As soon as I heard that, I'm like, yep. Yeah, big whoop.
Then how about if I said the name Carl Icahn?
Well, it only means something to us because we've been talking about him before.
Right. And we're going to talk about him just briefly here because I'm sure you really don't want to hear more about Lionsgate's management woes and the hostile takeover that Carl Icahn is attempting to take over Lionsgate, which means we are officially in our Inside Baseball segment where we discuss only the news stories Hollywood might care about. So just to get kind of run you through this really fast. Just a little bit of an update. In a strongly worded missive aimed at urging Lionsgate stakeholders to sell their shares to him by Wednesday, I guess is when the tender offer is going to be up, Carl Icahn admonished the company's board for its apparent, quote, ambivalence regarding Lionsgate fate. And what he's referring to is it looks like he's going to get about 28% of Lionsgate Entertainment. Other folks are selling them his shares. He owns 19 now. 4% of shareholders had agreed to sell him their shares before he extended his offer. And it looks like media entrepreneur and Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban will tender 5.4% of the company, which is what he owns. So he'll be up to 28%. Now, if Icahn is able to grab that much, any amount that he grabs over 20% would then call in Lionsgate's revolving credit facility. So I know, I just wish they'd get it over with already. Bottom line is, by owning more of Lionsgate, Icahn could force Lionsgate into bankruptcy. Why he would do that? I mean, it's just so, he's so mean. Anyway, so that's what's happening. Meanwhile,
so he sent out a memo.
No. Well, yes, you could say that. He sent out a letter to the...
Maybe he's taking lessons from James Cameron.
A memo?
Yeah. Another memo.
He's taking lessons from James Cameron.
Yes. But what we really should talk about is this LA Times article, No Black and White Answer to the Lack of Diversity on Television. And it's about the, well, lack of diversity on television. During Monday's House Judiciary Committee hearing on Comcast's proposed takeover of NBC Universal, Representative Maxine Waters, a Democrat from California, lamented the lack of TV shows aimed at minority viewers in general and black viewers in particular. What do you think about that?
Well, that's a big loaded question. I mean, are you asking me whether I agree with her and whether I think that there is a lack of TV shows that are geared towards minorities?
Yeah.
Yes.
No, I don't think so. But I'm a white girl, and so I'm almost not the person you should be talking to.
Well, I'm a white male, so I am the person you should talk to about this.
Well, okay. What do you think?
I disagree too. I mean, I think they're looking at fiction shows and only the major networks, which fair enough. It's always good to encourage more diversity. But boy, I think network television, and especially when you look at cable, is a lot more diverse than ever was, especially when you include reality shows. You see, I mean, the number one show is American Idol, which has people from all races and colors and body types. Dancing with the Stars is, you know, and Sunday Night Football. I'm looking at the top 15 shows. NCIS, very white. Undercover Boss, reality show, that's pretty diverse. Mentalist, white. CSI, a little bit of a mix.
Okay, but there are two questions here. I mean, I was understanding that the question was whether it's geared to minority audiences. Is that the question, or is it, are minorities
represented
fairly,
yeah,
on television?
No, it's shows aimed at minority viewers in general and black viewers in particular.
It's not just necessarily whether minorities are represented on these shows, because I would say that they are overwhelmingly white.
Yeah, and that's exactly what Suzanne DePass, a former president of Motown Television, said. She laid the blame on media consolidation, saying, quote, "I have witnessed what consolidation of content and distribution in entertainment and media has done to significantly slow down and diminish opportunity for minority professionals rather than accelerate and increase it." She went on to talk about the fact that, you're right, that minorities play smaller roles in some of these hit dramas and sitcoms, rather than like the Cosby Show, where it's about a minority family.
Well, I'd be curious to see how J.J. Abrams' new show, Michael, help me out, what's it called?
J.J. Abrams' new show.
It's basically Mr. and Mrs. Smith, but on TV, with Boris Kodjo and a woman whose name I can never pronounce. But they're both African-American, and it's the first time that I can recall that a show that was not specifically created about a black family was cast with two African-American leads. I think it's going to be interesting to see how it does. I bet it does well.
That's called Undercovers.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
The characters are Steven and Samantha Bloom, and the actors are Boris Kodjo and Gugu Mbatha-Raw.
Yeah, now you know why I can never remember her name.
It's true that they're, you know, and they also mentioned how like networks like Fox and CW and UPN launch themselves by focusing on minority viewers because they know they're underserved with shows geared towards them and reaching out to them. And then as they gain more and more success, they cut away those shows because they want to have big, broad, you know, viewership, and they're not, they ignore their minority audiences. And so that's fair. But I do think there's a lot more diversity than there was before. But, you know, the more shows with more diversity, the better.
Well, and Will Griffin, head of the video channel Hip Hop On Demand, said Madison Avenue has a misguided perception of the value of minority viewers. Quote, the root of the problem is this: advertisers' unwillingness to allocate minority marketing budgets in proportion to viewership ratings. So he's saying, hey, there are much bigger audiences to some of these minority shows than you actually think, and you're not actually giving them credit. Joe Flint wrote this
to make that more clear. Blacks and Latinos watch a lot of television, way out of their, you know, percentage of the population. And so they're watching a lot of TV, and you're going to reach them, and you should reach them, and you should focus your dollars on reaching them and acknowledge them as your viewers. That's why you see commercials with Latinos and Blacks and, you know, other people that much more than you would in the past, because they watch a lot of TV. So they're there, but they're not saying we're spending our ad dollars to reach them and acknowledging that and supporting programming that reflects them better. The secondary point he makes is that sometimes if you've got shows geared towards Blacks and only Black people are watching, like Girlfriends on UPN, and Latinos are only watching the George Lopez show or Mind of Mencia, and whites are only watching, you know, NCIS, that's not great either.
Yeah, he's talking about fragmentation. And he says, from a sociological standpoint, if everyone is watching their own channels, the common interests and common ground that we should all embrace gets lost. So you don't ever have these larger audiences that you can market to.
Which is why I think shows like American Idol, and when it was on The Cosby Show and others that reach everybody and bring in a huge diverse audience and reflect diversity, are the best of all possible worlds.
Kind of like this show, huge, diverse audience. So why are you laughing? What?
I hope Mark Sanchez was listening today.
I certainly hope so too. And you know what? If he was, he probably subscribed to the podcast through iTunes, where you can find it on the iTunes store, or the Zune Marketplace, where you can also find it. Or you can go to our website, where you can find links to either the Zune Marketplace or iTunes, although I think actually it's only iTunes. Either way, our website is at showbizsandbox.com, and that's where you'll find show notes for today's show with links to all of the stories we just discussed. It's also where you will find links to our social networking accounts, including Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, YouTube, you name it. It's also where you'll find ways to contact us. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address, or you can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. Again, that's toll-free, 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by MGMT, the popular indie rock group, who can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com. Karen Woodward can be found, well, I guess online, at karenwoodwardonline.com. Or
where else would I be found? I spend my entire life online.
That's true. In fact, we're not
sure. You may not even exist in reality.
Exactly.
I don't.
But you do exist on Twitter. @Karen_Woodward is the username to look up. Or you could follow Michael on Twitter. @MichaelGiltz is the username to look up.
And I just hit 100 followers, so I only need 999,900 more to hit 1 million.
But you don't really cultivate your Twitter following, do you?
I guess not.
You totally don't.
Yeah, well,
meaning because like you don't use things like at replies and retweets, and you're not talking to people. You use it primarily as a broadcasting medium. So the fact that you've got 100 followers is pretty amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, you use it to send out links to all of your writing on the Huffington Post and elsewhere. And if you don't want to go to Michael's Twitter account, you can go to his website and find those same links to his news pieces. MichaelGiltz.com is the website to visit. If you want to find links to any of my writing, which is primarily about the motion picture exhibition industry, you can do that at CelluloidJunkie.com. Or you can follow me on Twitter, @Sperling is the username to look up. Until next week, play nice.